a major speech that I was delivering to all black people. I imagine kind of a state of the black union with everybody around the world, and especially the U.S., tuned into to my words. Now, my brothers and sisters, I will tell you ways that the white man has led our people into this epidemic of violence. If you want to go way back, it all started when the Europeans invaded our rich, prosperous motherland and robbed her of her people. At the time of the slave trade, there were Africans who sold their own people for beads and jewelry. This was the beginning of our self-destruction. Another possibility is found by looking at the brutal times of slavery. During slavery, some of the brutalities were earth-shaking and unfathomable. And I remember being so proud of using the word unfathomable. And so I go and I blame the white man. I basically call for a reverse revolution against white people. And I turned in this paper very proudly, not at all conscious that this wasn't a normal thing to submit to a middle school English class at a place like Sidwell Friends. That was the Black Power Tunde speaking. And my English teacher came to me the next day, asked me to stay after class and said, "Hey, some pretty radical stuff you put in that paper. Would you have written that if I weren't black?" And I was like, "Absolutely not. And I expect you to keep our secret." But that was a moment, a flashpoint for me of conflict. Of I was kind of using the ability to manipulate words that I was picking up at Sidwell, but with the ideas that I was sucking up Saturdays at this Oncobia Society, and it turned out into this kind of militant speech that I hypothetically delivered.
Were you taught that all of black people's problems were really a conspiracy by white people?
Well, so here was the beauty, and this is why the mix is so important. Even I talk about my mother's evolution in her life. I talk about my mix in this neighborhoods. I was taught extremes and able to balance them because I was taught multiple extremes. So at a place like Sidwell, and Sidwell's a great school. It really is. But it was also a tough place to be one of the few minority kids, one of the few poorer kids, and there's a big social adjustment. And one of the arguments there was we need more black faculty. We need more black subjects in the curriculum. That always happens at any sort of school, especially kind of elite secondary and colleges. Meanwhile, in the Oncobia environment, it was Africa did this, Africa invented that, Imhotep this, blah, 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 and the white man caused these problems. Those either cancel each other out or they drive the bearer of both ideas insane.
Right.
I didn't go insane. And fortunately, and I think most people in that situation probably wouldn't. So it sort of encouraged me to both see the good in both sides and also challenge both perspectives.
Okay, so we've established that you were exposed to really different ways of seeing history, of seeing being black in America, and that was a really good thing for you.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
And then you went to Harvard.
I did.
And you say at Harvard is where you learned that some people could see your black skin as just a cover for the whiteness underneath. Not necessarily you, but one's black skin. So was that like your introduction to the whole, you know, quote, Oreo concept?
Well, the Oreo concept was, I was introduced to that at Sidwell. Sidwell was boot camp for me.
Right.
It was, okay, you're going to go train here so that you can enter the world, you know, the mainstream world of America. And it was actually my first, possibly my second day, but I'm pretty sure it was my first day at Sidwell that a black student who had been at the school for a really long time was assigned to be my buddy and adjust me to the environment. And he asked if I knew what an Oreo was. I actually, it's such a strong memory. We were in the first floor stairwell of the upper school building, southwest corner. I remember all this, southeast corner. I really thought he was talking about cookies. I was like, yeah, it's the cream-filled cookie from Nabisco. And he's like, no, man. Oreo is somebody's black on the outside and white on the inside. And then he made an example, and he's like, you see that kid across the way? He pointed across the dining hall a little later. He said, that kid's an Oreo. And I didn't even know the kid's name at the time. I saw this nerdy black kid with glasses hanging out with white friends, and I was like, he could be president someday. This is a good way to fundraise, you know, make white friends early. And that was the first introduction of this concept of sort of inauthentic blackness because you're comfortable around whiteness.
And if you were either introverted or like intellectual, bookish, would that add to an Oreo image?
It would. I mean, I think, again, I wish I almost have in my head an image of the layers of expectations around your identity. So at a school like Sidwell, first, let's just take the fun fact of a black kid who's been at Sidwell his entire life judging another black kid at Sidwell's blackness. It's like you're both been steeped in this environment, so why are you picking on that kid? But then you have the, you know, take someone like me who would go to Sidwell by day and then go back to my neighborhood, and the black kids there and their judgment of someone like me who goes off to the fancy white private school.
What was that judgment?
Well, so I never got hit with the heavy, like, you think you're white, in part because I think these kids just knew me, at least from the kids that actually knew me. But you will get it from kids who don't know you. I mean, as people, we're really good at judging people we don't know. That's part of how we move through the world, and we're programmed to do it. So you see some black kid in this environment, like, ah, sellout, Oreo. And it's just an instant mild envy, misunderstanding, and judgment about someone who you don't really get. And when you start equating success and literacy and achievement and hard academic work with white, and more importantly, with not black, then it becomes a little troubling, or actually I'd say very troubling. So I experienced a little dose of that, but mostly because I was interacting with kids who knew me and I had made that transition. They saw me make it. They were less harsh.
And also, I'm wondering if the African name Baratunde.
Yes, my black pass.
And also everything that you knew about, like, African history because of your Afrocentric schooling on the weekends. I mean, come on. You know what I mean? Like, you...
Actual knowledge never prevents people from judging you.
That's true, isn't it?
There was a great moment in the book. I interviewed people in this book as well, and one of them is a friend, Derek Ashong, who was born in Ghana, and he described an experience of being judged by black Americans, saying he wasn't black enough because he wasn't radical enough, because he hadn't written some middle school paper calling for the death of all white people. And he's like, slow down. I was born in Africa. Like, I can trace my family back generations. You can't out-black me. It's impossible. I am definitely, definitely black.
At Harvard, you say you learned how important and powerful the role of black friend to white people could be. Explain that.
A lot of white people like black people, right? They buy hip-hop. They like watching black athletic and sports figures and movie figures. And this black culture is super popular, from jazz through hip-hop and everything else that's come in between and beyond. And so having a black friend, which I think is actually in the book Stuff White People Like that Christian Lander wrote, is a mark of kind of progressive success as a white person. And the black friend that they have is usually seen as their asset. It's like, oh, I'm cooler by proxy. I can get my questions answered. I'm hip. What I try to describe in the book a little more is like what black people get out of having emissaries in the white community as the black friend.
What do they get?
Well, you have a covert operative behind enemy lines. You've got a trusted source who can shuttle information back and forth. It's like the Cold War. It's basically a back channel that prevents race wars from blowing up. So if your white friend has a question about something, they can ask you, their trusted black friend, and you can feed them real or false information depending on your purposes, but they don't necessarily have to just make an assumption or make a leap that ends up in some even more awkward, more public moment. So it's actually very important to have this cross-cultural exchange of actual friendship going on, and the black friend is a really, really big part of preventing that conflagration.
I want to quote something else from the book. You write that upon graduation from Harvard, you say, I was conscious of the fact that I could be me and thus be black, but not have to be black in order to be me.
Yeah.
Talk about that.
Harvard was a liberating experience, which I don't know many black people who would say that, but it was because of Sidwell. I spent 6 years at Sidwell Friends going through, there is a typical life cycle kind of minority in private school. First, they challenge your right to be there and say it's all affirmative action. You feel awkward. Your friends back home judge you as selling out. You have the black student union. You probably protest something. Someone writes the N-word on the wall or in the bathroom or in your locker. Like, these things are going to happen. And by the time I got to Harvard, I'd been through all of that. And then I could just, Harvard's a great place. It can be a really great place if you can enjoy it and take advantage of it. And I was able to do that there. So I was involved in the Black Students Association at Harvard. But at Sidwell, I felt this like absolute obligation to like fight and lead and protest and write reports. And at Harvard, I still was actively involved in that black community, but it wasn't the core source for like my full identity. And I felt as comfortable hanging out with the kids at the newspaper, hanging out the kids with the Computer Society and the theater kids. And black became more of a part of my identity and less of kind of an ongoing protest movement, which it can often be because you often feel besieged. And I was able to let go of that feeling of being besieged and just sort of be instead. And so there were protests and there were controversies, but I think I was able to not let them define me or limit my definition of myself, certainly not affect my feeling of a right to be there. And so many folks, that's a harsher transition when they haven't had the boot camp of some kind of private school to prepare them.
We're talking earlier a bit about your the Afrocentric part of your education.
Yeah.
Jack and Jill Politics is not an Afrocentric title by
no,
any means.
Not.
What is Jack and Jill Politics supposed to mean as a title?
Sure. It is, first of all, a political blog that I helped found with Cheryl Conti, who's my co-founder and also